almost. In terms of learning, e-learning, and all these web developments since 2001. So I think we have some similarities in the talks and in the discussions. Stephen is working for the National Research Council in Canada. Council of Canada is also running a daily newsletter. And I don't just want to guess what's coming now. Then maybe later on we'll bring it and get into discussion about the relations of you have presented to us and what we will hear right now about eLearn 2.0 platform, not eLearn. See if it goes yours.
Hi everyone. That was a fascinating presentation we just listened to, and I wish I had known that that was going to have that content before I did this, because then I could do a point-by-point discussion of that. But I do want to have you think about this presentation in the context of what we just heard. I'm going to talk about a technological model, but I want you also to think of it as a business model, and indeed even as a political model, because a lot of what we just saw has to do with productivity, employment, management, organization, and a lot of the presumptions and a lot of the concepts in the presentation that we just saw are in the process of changing. And I thought that the last slide highlighting the issues was probably the most important slide of the presentation. We were told, I think accurately, that knowledge workers are independent workers. But if you grasp what that means, and if you accept that something like that is true, and I believe that it is true, then concepts like determining the return on investment for a corporation for training investment become different. And concepts like the management of people become different, because they become things that you cannot manage anymore. And you have to understand how the people themselves flow rather than where you will put them. It's a fundamentally different way of looking at organization. And even the beginning of the presentation where we saw the Internet Readiness Index and things like that, now I've had a look at those documents, and those documents presume a certain sort, not simply technological organization, but also a social organization. And this social organization presumes, if you look at the criteria, presumes a certain type of business readiness. And I would argue that this type of business readiness is why Canada places below the United States on this list. My perspective, living in Canada and having visited the United States very frequently, is that that order should be reversed, that Canada is much more Internet ready than the United States. And the reason why I say that is, if you look, particularly if you look at the comparative size of the two economies, how much innovation is coming out of Canada as compared to the United States, especially in information and communication technology. So I know that's a preamble, and perhaps a controversial preamble, but I base that preamble on the content of what will follow. And I'm going to talk about technology, but this is beyond technology. It's looking at the types of people that are required, that chart with the philosophers and the Boolean. My background is in philosophy, and I find it interesting. I went through an entire process of education for which there was no discernible return on investment, no discernible productive gain. I studied epistemology and metaphysics, philosophy of mind. It turns out it was just a happy accident that the work that I did in philosophy today turns out to be the basis of a new industry. But when I studied philosophy, there was a little chart on the wall in the philosophy department, and it said, you will not get a job with this degree. This degree is not a route to employment. And they made us sign a little document. They really did. This was at the University of Calgary. That I would not blame them if I never got a job. I did it anyways because it was inherently worth knowing. And this is where business has a lot of difficulty in understanding that sometimes things are inherently valuable. Education is one of those things. The last slide shades into this slide. And what is happening is that we're moving to a fundamentally different mode of organization. Not just of companies, not just of individuals, but of knowledge itself. We're moving from a picture where these things are centralized to a picture where these things are distributed. Think back even to the days before the World Wide Web. Remember those days, way back before 94, early 90s, where we were expected to log on to these large centralized information services, Genie, CompuServe, Prodigy. Remember them, America Online? What happened is the web came in and decentralized all of that, so that instead of accessing a single information service, we started to access hundreds of them, thousands of them, tens of millions of them that were all linked together. Now, why did this happen? Well, the centralized services forced you into their mold. You had to adapt to their technology, to their proprietary language, to their services and offerings. And it became static and inflexible. What we find when we access a network of a wide variety of different offerings, we're able to have choice and flexibility. The World Wide Web is itself the example of the distributed sort of environment I want to talk about, where the resources are not centralized, they're not in a single place, but they're scattered all over the world. Resources are scattered, access is scattered, and users are scattered. And what we've been talking about an awful lot, especially in instructional technology, is integration. Not integration in the sense of putting things together to make one big thing, but integration in the sense of having one thing talk to another thing, one thing communicate or send messages to another thing. Different ways of doing integration. Now, we've heard a lot about service-oriented frameworks for e-learning. Even in the previous talk, we heard a bit about service-oriented frameworks. And the thing, I don't quite like this characterization. I know I shouldn't get up here and criticize my own slides, but I'm like that. There are two major approaches to this that I want to draw out and highlight. And one is the formal, precisely defined, almost semantic web type of organization. And the other is the loose, rough, fuzzy, open kind of organization. On the one hand, we have things like semantic web schemas, RDF, ontologies, formal vocabularies, all of that infrastructure, where the watchword is reliability, quality, trustworthiness of the data, and all of that. On the other hand, what people are mostly using out there to connect these disparate services and resources is loose and messy. RSS, for example, is a language that doesn't even have a proper formal specification. It has, well, according to Mark Pilgrim, has 9 different flavors, and there's probably more by now, where you can just add new elements if you want, where sometimes things work, sometimes things don't work, where the reliability of the data that's coming in is something that has to be assessed by the user rather than guaranteed by the provider. So there are different ways of organizing these things, different ways of integrating these disparate parts. What I want to draw out is that although we're moving to a fundamentally new type of organization, it doesn't follow that we know nothing about how to approach this new type of organization. I've put on the slide here, sensible design principles. These principles are based on the idea that what we're working with is fundamentally a network. And networks have known properties. We've seen some of the analyses of networks by people like Duncan J. Watts. We've seen the principles of social networking. And there are different types of networks. Some networks are successful. Other networks are less successful. For example, some networks are highly centralized. A broadcast industry would be a highly centralized type of example. Other networks are highly decentralized. For example, the telephone network, whereby each of us can call any other person in the network. So let's have a look at these design principles. Again, these design principles are based in an understanding of networks. They form the basis for the instructional technology that I work on. But it, as I mentioned at the outset or at the start of this talk, they are also, or they should also be understood as business principles or even as political principles. I'm not really supposed to say that last. We'll pretend I did. And we'll pretend I didn't. And the way I use these, or the way I recommend that you use these, not simply to inform your own decisions when you are designing new technology, but when you are making technological decisions, each one of us has to, at any given point in time, decide whether to buy a certain system for our schools or our colleges or even for our offices, and use these principles to evaluate whether something is a good technology or a less good technology. I don't like saying bad. First, and I think crucially, the new technologies will be decentralized, should be decentralized. The centralized networks have a characteristic star shape. They're hierarchical, where some entities have very many connections, but the vast majority have very few. In terms of network analysis, I'm describing here the long tail and the big spike. The big spike would be the very popular providers of content or services, like Google, or a popular blogger, like, I don't know, Instapundit, who have millions of readers or thousands of readers. In a decentralized network, however, the emphasis is not so much on single points that have many connections, but rather the idea is that you're trying to distribute the connections so that each member of the network will have some connections, but no member of the network will have a large number of connections. The network looks, instead of like the star, it looks much more like a mesh. An example of that sort of thing is the peer-to-peer network, or community networks, where each person will have, you know, the 10 or 100, somewhere in that range, friends. But nobody has a million friends. Who could have a million friends? The reason why the decentralized network is favored is because it's inherently much more stable than the centralized network. The centralized network is susceptible to cascade phenomena. If the centralized network, if something goes wrong with one of these nodes that has a million connections, then the result propagates through the network very quickly. The decentralized network ideas, concepts, whatever, will flow through the network in a much more controlled manner. So it's not so susceptible to go gyrating wildly out of control. Second principle, distributed resources. Instead of putting everything in one place, you put things in different places. We'll see that come up very explicitly later on in this talk in the design of what's being called the personal learning environment. The idea here is that your data is, or your resources or whatever, are not all put in one system, one location, or on one site. Typically today, a person who logs online, they'll have photos on Flickr, they'll have bookmarks in Delicious, they'll have blog entries in Blogger. You notice how these things are all in distributed places. Now, there are some companies, Yahoo, for example, who are trying to bring everybody into that one big place. This is going to turn out, in the long term, to be less sustainable than the model where people have their data in distributed places. Universities and colleges typically try to get everything into one place. Let's get all of our learning content onto our server. Again, this is a less stable way of organizing your online presence than having it in a distributed way. The emphasis here is on sharing. Rather than having extra copies of things, you bring in information and data as you need it. Disintermediation. What this is, and think of this too as a business principle. Think about what this means as a business principle. What this is removing the link between, if you will, producer and consumer, author and reader, writer, or, you know, teachers and students. The traditional mediators, the editors, the producers, the publishers, and so on, have tended to act as filters and as barriers. And there have been in the past good reasons to have that. Books, for example, were a scarce medium. And consequently, we could not publish everything that could possibly be published. So you had to pick. Now, we're finding more and more that you can publish everything. And we don't need people to decide what is worthy of being published and what is not worthy of being published. You publish everything, and then the readers as a whole decide what they want to read and what they don't want to read. Disaggregation. We saw a fair amount of talk about this yesterday, and this very much speaks directly to the point of micro-content and micro-learning, where we try to break down the units of content as much as possible, or as some people have said in the realm of online learning, unbundling education, unbundling learning. If you think about how learning is traditionally practiced today, it's presented in the form of a course, but a course is a bundled package of what? 30, 40 lessons or classes. Even if you look at the material that constitutes a course or even a lesson, it might be some test, an image, a test, and these are all bundled. Formally, if we look at things like the IMS specifications, these things are formally bundled in a thing called a content package. But the idea here is to unbundle these. You unbundle these and take these apart, and you bring them in only when and if and as you need them. This is a hard principle, this principle of disintegration, but it's an important principle. Again, this came up yesterday. Some people were talking about, well, you put micro-content together, and it's micro-content is the small things that compose together a larger, complicated thing. And I forget who exactly it was that was saying this, and you have complex things, by contrast, which are a different domain. And I didn't really, and I'm not explaining that as well as I'd like, but I didn't really like that characterization. But what I want to get at is this. The individual bits of content, which we've taken apart, they've been unbundled, they're distributed, they're forming a network with each other, they do not come together. In learning technology, we went through this whole process of something called learning objects. And learning objects are very similar to today's micro-content. And the picture that people had of learning objects was that they were like Lego blocks. And you put them together, right? You get a bunch of content together and boom, 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 you form a wall. It doesn't work that way. and you can't picture it though. There's a bunch of reasons why it doesn't work that way. For one thing, it's incredibly difficult to get content to fit into each other properly. For another thing, it's just not the way content works in a network environment. The way you want to picture this, picture it. See, there was also this model, David Wiley had this model of learning objects being like atoms, right? So, you know, you take two hydrogen learning objects and one oxygen learning object, and you got the little water learning object. And a better model, think of these bits of content as though they formed, I don't even want to say a gas or a liquid because that still isn't quite right. But think of them as being associated with each other, connected to each other, not by virtue of the way that they're shaped or organized, but by virtue of communications one to the other. In other words, a state change in one can cause a state change in another, so that they form something like what some people have characterized as an environment or an ecology. You get a different picture of the way these contents relate to each other. Another way to think of it is like this. Think of these bits of content as being like words. Now, words don't plug together. You can take any two words and sort of put them beside each other. Aardvark, Vienna. See, I just put two words and they're completely unassociated. But the way we get meaning from that is the organization, the manner in which we put these words together, how we structure them. Language is linear. These objects allow us a three-dimensional way of putting these things together, but it's a matter of organizing these things in a certain way, and when they're in that way, you get meaning. Think of an MTV video. Oh, my content has suddenly stopped. An MTV video, you'll see some images, you'll see some music, you'll see some symbology, you might see some words, and what the way one of these things is presented to you is sort of like this. And you see all that as a whole, these things are all related to each other, and you get a single picture out of that, a single thought, single meaning forms into your head. But it's different for you and for you and for you, because you're looking at that from a different perspective. It's a hard concept. Democratize. There's one for the business people. Funny, everybody talks about how great democracy is, how important it is that we have in our society, but as soon as we move into the business environment, somehow this is wrong. Somehow this is inefficient. It's not the way it should be done. Autonomy. Entities in the network are autonomous. By entities in the network, I mean resources, I mean applications, I mean individuals, people, students. They are autonomous. They act, and this is one of the criteria of learning objects even, they're self-contained. Now that does not mean that they do not interact. People, you know, I talk about people, self-directed learners, and the first criticism that comes at me is, oh, self-directed learners, however will they know what to do? Well, they could ask someone, right? You know, being autonomous doesn't mean being stupid. That's a line I should write down. Being autonomous means making your own choices about what connections to make. Autonomy in terms of a software application means that the application can stand alone. Now, it doesn't mean that the application has no contact with other applications. In fact, it's a network application. It should have contact with other applications. But it does so not via integration, not via becoming part of another application or embedding itself into an operating system, but rather via messaging, such as APIs or web services even, or remote procedure calls, or whatever. But through communication back and forth, rather than being part of the same thing. this means, importantly, that you don't control these remote autonomous things. They do what they do according to their own priorities. This applies as much to your students, your workers, your data even, and certainly your applications as to anything else. A good way to think of this, if you're familiar with Marvin Minsky, Society of Mind, look at his autonomous agents. Each agent is out there, and the agent's just doing its own thing, right? Just, you know, all I want to do is find this and put it here. That's all I want to do. Agents aren't very smart, typically. And they just go about doing what they do. But the collection of agents working together produce intelligence. Dynamic, dynamize. In learning, we, and not just learning, elsewhere as well, but especially in learning, we have this idea that knowledge, that content, that everything is static. Look at how we manage knowledge in a university environment. We put it in paper, of all things. But who would do that? Put it in paper, and then we put it on the shelf, and we expect it to stay there for days, weeks, months, years, as though this static knowledge never changes. Typically, when people design online learning modules or online learning courses, they're typically expected to have a shelf life of a certain number of years, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever. But what you want to think of is knowledge, rather, is something that flows, that changes, constantly changing, constantly moving. Look at the education blogosphere, for example. The education blogosphere, at any given point in time, is one representation of the state of knowledge in educational technology. But what happens in the education blogosphere is every single day, several hundred people, 300, 400 people, produce new bits of knowledge. And these new bits of knowledge go into the network and sort of slowly overlap or replace older bits of knowledge. So you have a constantly influx, changing dynamic of knowledge happening here. Desegregation. This is different. Now, how do I want to put this? Because in the talk we just heard, we heard about collaboration, multidisciplinary things. This means the same thing as that, but differently. And how can I say that? There are organizations, some of which I won't name, that have embraced the idea of what they call horizontal collaboration, whereby you get people from very different disciplines to organize into teams, multidisciplinary teams, and to work together to solve a particular problem, such as wellness or sustainable energy or whatever. There's a couple ways this sort of thing happens. One way is you have a manager, and the manager says, "You will integrate." That's the wrong way. The right way is to stop thinking of what you as an individual, as an autonomous individual, do as being part of a certain domain. You see the difference. I use myself as an example. I work with people in various disciplines, education, computing science, philosophy even, although they don't talk to me much anymore, media, a number of other disciplines. But the idea here is that, and I consciously see this in myself, I'm talking one language to the reporters, another language to the computer scientists, another language to the philosophers, but they don't understand it, another language to the educators and the educational technologists, and you see what I mean? And so I see myself as touching or interacting with these different disciplines. Now, this is not something that is managed for me. This is something I do myself. And I do it myself because as an autonomous knowing individual, my understanding is that I can get ideas from these different sources. That is very different from me going in and I am the educational technologist part of a team. Right? And there'll be the educational technologist, and there will be the computer scientist, and there will be the human resources or human capital. I hate that phrase, human capital. Take that out of your slides. Humans are not capital. Humans will never be capital. The tools. I may have web access, I may not. We'll see what happens. We've seen the tools of this new organization proliferate across the web. Right there, we've got the latest phenomenon, MySpace. People are going online and creating their own profiles in MySpace. MySpace is, well, as we saw yesterday, started as a music service, or band, fan club type service. It's now much more than that. It's much more like a social networking environment. But as Dana Boyd accurately comments, it's also a place where people go online to create their own identity. I think it's, I had a couple of slides. I took them off this presentation, but I think they're still important. Identity. People create their own identities now. And people's identities, identity used to be you get your identity by belonging to something, right? I'm an Austrian, right? You belong to Austria, that's my identity. Or, I'm a Freemason, or even I'm a carpenter, I belong to the group, But today, people define their own identities. I am what I will be. I am what I make myself. I am what I create. I am whatever I am based on my set of connections. I am, I know such and such. I interact with these people. Identity is much more fluid, and you can have more than one identity if you want. I have several identities, some of which I won't tell you about, some of which I will. More instances of net-generated content, blogs and wikis. We all know about blogs and wikis. This year's big phenomena, podcasting, creating your own audio, creating your own video, creating your own animations. There's been a proliferation of these sites. And notice a lot of them are following these sorts of network principles, right? They this is a place to put your videos. That's all it is, right? You put your videos up there, and then you use RSS or something like that to syndicate your videos to your website or to your MySpace account or wherever. Same thing with Flickr. Right? You have your Flickr account, upload your photos to Flickr, use RSS, put your photos on your website, or embed them in your MySpace account. Whatever. In learning, the same sort of phenomenon is happening. We're moving from the learning management system, the Blackboards, the WebCTs, even the Moodles, towards something that is loosely being called the personal learning environment. I was at a PLE seminar in Manchester just a couple days ago, and people were saying, well, we don't really like calling it an environment, so we'll just call them the PLs. But we don't really like to say that they're specifically focused on learning. Remember, we're not in one discipline anymore. But we didn't want to just call them the P's, so we weren't really sure what to call them. But the idea here is that, again, these are individually based places that allow us to work with all of this content in remote locations. Here's the classic diagram. Let's see if I have web access and I can give it to you, big version. So give it 50-50. Nope. Cannot locate the internet. It's out there. Okay. I have no web access at the moment, so I won't be able to show this to you. But this is the classic diagram. The personal learning environment is the thing in the center. And then you notice all around it, these are these remote applications, this freestanding data, these freestanding applications that are communicating with each other. My own approach to this is to take content from multiple sources, to bring it together, and then to create for the person an environment where they bring this content together, they can work with it, aggregate, remix, repurpose, and then they can feed it forward to a blogging application or to any one of these other applications. This is e-learning 2.0 in a nutshell, where instead of a model of learning where you have broadcasters or publishers or some other authority figures or intermediaries producing reified content that will stand as an authority on a certain subject and broadcasting it to these passively receptive students, we have a picture of educational content that is to a large degree itself produced by the students. We completely break down the relation between producer and consumer, where the process of working with this material becomes in itself the educational process. The production of learning content is at one and the same time learning. In such an environment as well, and thinking of these network principles, the distinction between teacher and learner is itself broken down, where a teacher in one context may be a learner in another context, and vice versa, where the mechanisms, the software, the tools that a teacher and a learner have are roughly the same. The asymmetry of technology and the asymmetry of power between the teacher and learner is balanced. It becomes a symmetry. The advantage of PLEs, people have their own data. They have their own knowledge. It doesn't just disappear on them. They have their own identity. They are their own person. They engage in what I call self-identification. My own approach to self-identification, I put under the heading of MIDM, or MIDME. If you look up MIDM on Google, you'll find that system described. Again, it's a mechanism of identification which is distributed. There is not a central repository of identification. We tried that. It was called Passport. It didn't work. Copyright and reuse. The free flow of information, the free flow of content through the system. And I'm going to have to stop here because I've run out of time, but I want to make one final point, that what I'm talking about when I'm talking about this personal learning environment is not an application, not a tool, it's an approach. It's a way of thinking about web technology. So that's my talk. I wish I had more time, but I don't. But thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
I'm very happy that you are so Canadian. You know, the homeschooling movement between the Algonquin Park and James Bay. Two things. One is your design principles raise important questions regarding who assures quality. What mechanisms, in which way does quality actually define itself and be delivered? In which way do we have and provide orientation? And what is the function of defining boundaries and thresholds? And I think that this is very, very important because if you have design principles for learning, I think it is important to talk about these things and develop adjusted concepts for this. The second thing is, you live in a country which has democratized itself, I mean, next to a country which has democratized itself sufficiently to elect George Bush as president. And in that sense, I think that your assumption that the collection of agents produces intelligence has to be questioned. I'm putting this polemically because I live in a country here in Austria where populism is rampant and where the skepticism about that democracy produces intelligence is highly justified. I think that one has to step back three lines when you try to put principles like, for instance, democracy, which are important principles for respect and equality in terms of access to political control, into a learning and into a knowledge sphere, where I think that one has to look at the experience and wisdom are of different kind of qualities. I take Richard Strauss a little side mark again. I think what Theo Hook and I have been talking about, the number of different kind of forms of the necessity in terms of blended approaches to learning, to be an indication that when Richard Strauss talks about the importance of the tutoring relationship, then it talks about a way of non-democratic kind of learning relationships where you try to model yourself along things which are important. Last point on this is even in very distributed philosophies, like for instance Asian philosophies, the role of the master is a very, very important one. And in your e-learning 2.0, you have created a vision of radical equality, which is actually leveling the kind of differences which we need to have in order to recognize for ourselves the challenges and opportunities to learn.
All right, those are great questions.
It was
two questions. Well, actually, I counted three. That doesn't matter. Look. Let me give the glib answer first because it's more fun. The George Bush thing. And let's not forget that George Bush had a long career in the corporate world before he was elected president and went from running one company after another company into the ground. And so George Bush is a product of the corporate world much more than he is a product of democracy. I mean, look, a lot of what characterizes American democracy and indeed democracy on a wider scale today characterizes those old models that I'm trying to argue against. The models of centralization, the models of management and control, the models of non-autonomy. Think about how we do this. We elect leaders by popular vote, in other words, by some sort of mass action, and we get as a result somebody who really has no formal qualifications to, say, manage a fishery, and then we put them in charge of the fisheries, and then because of the way we structure organization and government, whatever this person says about the fisheries must now be obeyed without question by the entire fisheries ministry. And the result is we run out of fish. And that is the reality where I live. Let's address this head on. I mean, the question is, who ensures quality, right? Historically, any mechanism of having an individual agent ensure quality has failed. And the reason why it has failed is because at some point in time, either that authority becomes corrupt or that authority finds itself unable to manage the complexity that ensuring quality entails. Historically, that is what has happened. In the world of the internet, we're seeing different mechanisms happen whereby quality is determined distributively, where each individual acting autonomously, if you will, gives a thumbs up or a thumbs down to a piece of information. Each individual acting autonomously adds or changes or subtracts a piece of information. Look at something like Wikipedia. Wikipedia was created by a large collection of non-experts. Each non-expert working autonomously, nobody controlling them, and yet in a scientific study conducted by Nature, Wikipedia turns out to be roughly as accurate as Encyclopedia Britannica. And Wikipedia costs much less to produce. And Wikipedia is not only authoritative, it is up to date in a way that Britannica can never be up to date. And Wikipedia can be corrected this evening. Encyclopedia Britannica, we have to wait for another edition to come out. It's very similar to James Surowiecki's The Wisdom of Crowds, where because each of us perceives a phenomenon or set of phenomena from a certain perspective, a certain point of view, each of us brings a slightly different bit of knowledge to that phenomenon. And because each of us brings that slightly different point of view, we collectively are able to take into account far more factors, far more variables, orders of magnitude more factors, more variables than any individual or even any small group. And consequently, the decisions that we make as groups acting autonomously tend to be better. And that is the principle of democracy. And historically, we have seen that governments, George Bush notwithstanding, elected democratically, tend to be better at running the country than governments not elected democratically. Because each of us individually chooses a slightly different way of looking at who best to govern.
What do you answer Tom Sandoval with his complaints, which I think is a very valid one, how people start to overwrite in the Wikipedia environment definitions which somebody like himself wants to be authoritative on, taxonomy as a key example, which needs precision and also stability at the category term and also as a classificatory pivot for a lot of different kind of phenomena. And then people come out of ignorance, sometimes out of maybe spite, override it, and basically dilute in the course the knowledge advantage of that term. How do you answer that? That is, I would say, the curse of democracy in terms of learning.
Okay. The presumption is that this one person is in a better position than all of these other people to speak authoritatively on a given subject. There are two possibilities. Either that person is in fact authoritative or they are not. If they are not, then it doesn't matter if the thing gets overwritten, right? Because they weren't authoritative to begin with. A lot of these cases that I see where somebody is saying there should be an authoritative thing written about a certain subject, what they mean is a certain subject should be treated from a different point or from a particular point of view, right? And anything that varies from that point of view is somehow wrong or ignorant, okay? But of course that's not the case. And it's just simply different points of view competing in the same environment. We're more interested, though, in the case where the person is, in fact, a genuine authority. If the person is, in fact, a genuine authority, then in a community environment such as Wikipedia, or for that matter, in the blogosphere or elsewhere in a distributed environment, all of these environments work the same way, that authority must be demonstrated rather than assumed by position. See, this person's coming into Wikipedia and just sort of saying, I'm the authority. You have to listen to me. But it doesn't work that way. If the person is, in fact, an authority on a certain subject, then they need to demonstrate that authority by authoring Wikipedia articles in such a way that not only they, but the readership, the people in general, will support the preservation of that wording of that article in that way. You see what I mean? You have to not just be an authority, you have to show.
I don't agree.
Martin, may I ask you, please, just one question out of please.
So, quite a funny question. But it has something to do with this. I'm interested in knowledge getting independent from people's minds, so e-learning 2.0 is always conceptualized, I think, or mostly conceptualized as people communicating, which is true in a way. But I'm interested in knowledge getting independent in that process. There's something abstract and objective developing which is not within the minds of people and not in the communication of people. So Wittgenstein has this metaphor of knowledge landscape, and you are crisscrossing the knowledge landscape. But in fact, it doesn't speak about knowledge, it spoke about language. But language is knowledge in a way. So I'm interested in structures of microcontent that may form knowledge, and where we as teachers, and I'm a teacher too, we could construct guided tools through the knowledge landscapes. And I think that would be a worthwhile thing to do, not just letting people do as they want, which is willing to, I hope I'm not against that, but constructing guided tools for knowledge landscapes. And I want to know how can I do that in the e-learning field of the old environment.
Big question.
My first reaction. You guys never watch karate movies, do you? Karate movies. You should watch karate movies. Because the previous question had the same sort of elements of, you know, like, you've got guided tours, and the previous question talked about putting yourself in the hands of the master. And, like,
okay.
Right, and like autonomy doesn't mean being stupid, right? You voluntarily put yourself in the hands of a master. You watch these karate movies, right? There's always this point near the beginning of the movie where the master says, "You are not worthy to be my student." The person has to go, like, walk up 10,000 steps to prove that, right? Like, it's a complete, look at education today where you are required to put yourself in the hands of the master, as compared to these karate movies where you choose to put yourself in the hands of the master. It's a very different thing. Now, I have talked about the independence of knowledge from individual minds in the past, and the idea of knowledge being distributed. The example that I've used is the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from Frankfurt to Toronto. And if you think about that knowledge, how to do that knowledge resides in no particular person, does it? Because no one person knows how to build a 747, much less an airport, which you need, how to take off a 747, how to navigate that 747 across the ocean, and how to land that 747 in Toronto without breaking it. It takes thousands of different people, and the knowledge of how to fly a 747 is scattered across all of those different people, and those people working together produce that knowledge. And the way that works is according to the principles that I've described, where each person is working, doing their own thing, working autonomously. Okay. Now, that does not mean working without direction. Again, everybody assumes because you are autonomous, nobody can ever tell you what to do, right? But I'm here of my own free will, right? Nobody forced me to come. And when somebody tells me to stop talking, I will in fact stop talking. Not because I'm being forced, but because I voluntarily put myself in a situation of interaction where I allow this control to happen in order to produce some sort of knowledge that transcends just myself, transcends any individual in this group. And so there's that. Now, I want to point out, you mentioned Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein was under no illusions about the nature of this knowledge, and this is important. This knowledge is not objective reality. This knowledge constitutes a point of view. Wittgenstein used the phrase riverbed propositions, riverbed shifting, changing dynamics, or language games, right? Where we decide implicitly as a matter of protocol rather than specification or stipulation that we will sort of roughly follow a certain arranged set of practices. But your view of the language game is different from my view of the language game. The language game exists independently of us, but it is not an objective reality independently of us. It is what the philosophers call supervenient. It depends completely on the individual constituents of which it is a part.
Okay, thank you. So, I keep back my questions. I have many questions here, and I think we could have a long discussion. I want to open up two or three questions for the audience. Are there any family similarities in terms of Wittgenstein's in your minds now, or contracts, or whatever? Any remarks, questions, comments to what's been presented and discussed so far? Please, George.
Just a quick point of clarification, Stephen. I think one of the challenges will go to Wittgenstein's language games again, but language defines what we're saying or what we're using or what we're trying to use. We're extracting meaning from the words and the language that people are using. I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Stephen, that you're stating that formal structure of learning is a bad thing. I'd like a clarification on that. I've been using the analogy of ecology that is really elements, every element has a place, and at one point in time, in fact, religion was talking about earlier as well, that the tool has to match the task. There are certain things that require structured processes. So just to clarify, I think some of the questions created as an all or nothing proposition, I personally didn't read that in your presentation.
Sure. If you look at my works, anyone who looks at my work would find it absurd to conclude that I don't think there's any such thing as structure. I mean, the very first thing that I put online was a guide to logical fallacies that was entirely based on structure. There are structures. Of course there are structures. It's the manner in how these structures are created, how the different components interact between them, what the nature of these structures is, that's important. But you know, formal, I mean, this is the thing with language, right? Formal, the word formal has many different meanings and many, many different ways of looking at it. And in one meaning of the word formal, formal means anything that can be abstracted in some way so that you have a variable, right? Well, I work in variables all the time. And that, as soon as I have a variable, that gives me some kind of structure, right? And so it's always the nature of these structures that I'm after. But the other thing is, this, and a key point is, the structure is not everything. Abstraction is always abstraction. And any time you abstract, what you're doing is removing something from whatever it is you're abstracting. And you remove different things according to your perspective. And we always have to keep that in mind, that the abstraction, the formalism, never itself becomes the reality. And that's where I'm a non-formalist. I don't believe in a realism of form.
I have a question on clarification. Did you say you're free choice? I mean, to me, your statement sounds very much what I heard in school in religion. Okay, I have free will to do things, but I better do it the church's way, otherwise I'm going to stand. And these free choices in the everyday life are like that. If I don't want to study, I don't want to learn, I will be uneducated, and I will have problems. Okay, I mean, total hell is actually now, let's say, girl. Can you clarify what you really mean? Because I don't think you mean that.
Fascinating.
Another big question.
Well, no, I mean, it's it's the kind of question, right? Because you can't break the law of gravity. You are a law-abiding citizen. It's based on an equivocation. There's two approaches to this. There are two aspects to your question. And they're being blended together. And the one aspect is the cold, hard reality. If you don't learn anything, then you will be stupid and you will die, to put it bluntly, right? And the other aspect of the question is, given a choice, some people will choose not to learn. I want to draw those two things out. It's important to draw those out. The first reflects a natural law, right? If you do not learn, then you will not be learned, right? If you do not learn, you will make mistakes in your life, you will have a hard time and all of that. That's a natural law, right? And that's going to be true, doesn't matter what my view is. That's not what you meant. That's kind of what was there, but that's not what you meant. What you meant was, given a choice, some people will choose not to learn. Empirically, you see now, you see the difference, right? Empirically, that turns out to be false. Empirically, you cannot find people who don't learn, right? I challenge you. Find one person who hasn't learned. Well, of course, everyone learns because humans are learning systems. That's what our brains do. So implicit in your question is, what if they don't learn the right thing? Right? You see how now I've changed it, right? The question was formulated as a natural law question, but it was in fact a question about values. And now we come to who chooses the right thing? What makes you the authority of what is right for someone to learn? If I listened to, say, the business community, or my parents, or my church, I never would have studied philosophy. And then I'd be working in a convenience store. Right? So, the question is, for an individual, an autonomous individual, capable of making their own decisions, who decides what they should learn? And I argue that individual should decide. And the reason why I argue that is because, in general, that is how we will get the best decisions. Historically, when you try to manage complex processes, like the learning of an entire population, you mess it up. But historically, if people choose their own way, you get overall better results. That's my response. I know you don't agree with it, but what is the basis on which you say that somebody else has made a bad choice to study music or to study sports or whatever?
You're always talking about higher education. I talk about basics, learning to read, learning to calculate. I mean, if I give a child a choice, they may not do any of that, watching television.
Sure. Seymour Papert addresses this because he's learning in games and all of that. And I always just echo Papert's response. I remember I was at where was it? Was it somewhere in the States? I forget where. And the person in the crowd sort of came up and said, people have to learn the foundations, right? They have to learn the foundations that they need to get by. They have to learn reading, and they have to learn writing, and they have to learn religion. And I'm sort of scratching my head. What Papert says is, if something is foundational, then the need for it will become apparent when you are trying to do something that is non-foundational. If, in fact, empirically, reading is an essential skill, then in order for a person to do what they choose to do, they will need to learn to read. And, in fact, that's what they will do. I needed to learn how to rotate squares on a computer screen. You know, because I was trying to make a Star Trek game, to rotate squares. And it turns out, in order to rotate a square on a computer screen, you need to know trigonometry. Right? Now, I studied trigonometry in high school. I studied trigonometry in college. I studied trigonometry in university. And then later, when I went to rotate a square, that's when I learned trigonometry.
Okay. Last question by Sebastian Bielerwitz.
Steve, I just wanted to add on the point.
Yeah. Or,
just wanted to add an issue here, because I think that's something that sort of flies on the radar at this conference also. We touched on it. We're mostly, I think, talking about higher education. Mm-hmm. And then some people, they talk about learning and learning technologies, they think also about qualification and accreditation. And I think this is where these two discourses are running apart, because you and I tend to do the same kind of thing. Talk about life, you talk about people, you know, finding their place in the world and then finding their own ways of how to learn about this world, how to build their own identities and stuff like that. But we have a lot of people who basically tie to this idea of certification and qualification, how to sell it, how to formalize it, how to, you know, put a price ticket on it, and all this. And so I would like to hear from you, what's your vision on this whole qualification issue, and how you see this coming along with what you just presented.
Someone's going to become a multimillionaire one day by separating qualification from learning. And then another person will become a multimillionaire by realizing that you don't have to tie learning to qualification anymore. Right now we have a system of learning that is tied inextricably, it seems, to productive capacity, which is why we talk about the purpose of learning to produce employable graduates, to increase productivity, to generate net return on investment, and all of that. But ultimately, the purpose of learning is to have a better life. And that is why any individual will choose to learn. Now, you can force a person to learn in a corporate environment. You can force a person to learn at a grade school level. But ultimately, the learning will happen when that person decides for themselves, for purposes of their own choosing, that learning is worthwhile. We spend a lot of time and money trying to convince people to do what they're told, when really, if they just wanted to do what they wanted to do, then they would learn it in that much more efficiently. But the reason for the structuring of the system this way is because, in fact, qualifications are important to us. We need to know and know that our knowledge is justified, that people who are performing certain services for us are qualified to do so. I will, after I'm finished here in Austria, get onto a 747 and fly to Toronto. And I know that the various people involved in that process are qualified. And I have a reasonable degree of assurance that when they attempt to land this aircraft, that they will do so successfully rather than rapidly. How do we do that? Right. And the answer is, there's no single mechanism. The answer is, different mechanisms apply in different domains. And it's sort of odd that we have one single standardized way of doing it, right, a multiple choice test, which turns out not really to be that effective. Airline pilots, the way we know is we put them in a simulator. If they successfully land the simulator, then we put them in an airplane, hopefully an empty one, and if they successfully land the airplane enough times, we say they're qualified. And if they don't, they're dead. No, I'm just kidding. But you know what I mean. Medical people, doctors and that, again, they perform on simulators, they perform on dummies, they demonstrate procedures. They show their knowledge through various mechanisms, and only after a period of apprenticeship as an intern, where they're gradually allowed to practice, do we actually say they're a doctor, right? Each one of these professions has a different way of demonstrating qualification. There is no reason to tie these mechanisms of demonstrating qualification to the act of learning itself. If I can demonstrate that I can successfully perform open heart surgery, logically, there's no reason why I should not be allowed to perform it. Now, in practice, it turns out to be extraordinarily difficult to learn how to perform open heart surgery by yourself. Right. You need hearts. But as we move into increasingly sophisticated simulations and other environments, And as we are able to demonstrate our qualifications, not simply to a small board of testers, but to the public as a whole, it becomes more and more possible to demonstrate our qualifications, show that we can do something, rather than refer to some sort of certification. Once we hit that, I think we're reasonably close to that particular tipping point now, then learning does in fact separate from testing. And once learning separates from testing, then a lot of what we have to say about learning, how we choose learning, what forms of learning we use, a lot of that will go by the wayside. There's lots of argument against informal learning now because it's so difficult to test for it. But once people can demonstrate their qualifications, people will be all over informal learning. It'll be really hard to justify making somebody go through a degree to prove that they can do something when they can just prove it directly. So that's how I would approach that. And you know, that's the short version of a much longer answer.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Steve. I won't go into it because for me it's important to see in your answer to this question, especially the institutional aspects, the certification, qualification, and all that, and the vision you brought up in your talk and also in the discussions is right the opposite of what's happening with e-learning, and especially in relation to the Bologna process. Yeah. Here in Europe, this norming, this new bureaucracy, is putting everything down into certain pockets and so on and so forth. So long discussion.
Not just Europe.
Yeah, not just Europe, okay. Well, thanks for coming here. Thanks for the talk again. Thanks for the audience, for the questions. Give it a hand, please.